I wrote my first novel when I was 6 years old. It was 2.5 pages long in an exercise book. Of course, I'd always wanted to write plays. I just always had it.
Writer Alan Seymour talking about his lifelong desire to live by the pen. Hello and welcome to Verbatim. Michelle Rayner joining you with another life story today which illuminates aspects of Australian cultural history. Alan Seymour was born in Western Australia, and through the 1940s and 50s, he established himself as a radio writer and presenter, both in Perth and in Sydney. Later, he became involved in the fledgling television industry, which emerged here in the latter half of the 1950s. But Alan Seymour is probably best known in this country for his play The One Day of the Year, which created a major fracas when it was chosen to be performed at the inaugural Adelaide Festival of the Arts in 1960. The play took on some of the biggest sacred cows in Australia, the Anzac legend, and the question of class. Hearing local vernacular on stage in Australia at this time was still a shock, but it was Alan Seymour's stinging portrayal of the uglier side of the Anzac Day commemorations which put the play in the firing line for some of the members of the Adelaide Festival Committee and led to the banning of the official production of the play. This didn't stop local performances, plus a season in London, and the play remained as a text on the school curriculum for decades. After the Adelaide Festival imbroglio, Alan Seymour found that there was more writing and adaptation work in the offing in Britain, and he moved there permanently in 1962. Among many other BBC TV productions, he adapted L.P. Hartley's novel The Go-Between and C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, both for the little screen. As someone who's made a living from that most precarious of vocations, the writing life, I asked Alan Seymour whether his passion for words had been encouraged during his childhood.
Well, it was a working class family with no great literary feelings, but I wasn't discouraged, shall we say. My parents were really quite old by the time I came along. I was the ninth. They had that kind of family in those days. And then finally, 14 years after my youngest elder sister, if you work that out, I came along. Surely a mistake. And then when I was nine, by the time I was nine, both my parents had died, and I went to live with my oldest sister. She and her husband had books in the house, and I would read them. And I read everything practically they had, and my sister encouraged me to join the local library, the Fremantle Literary Institute. This is in Fremantle, Western Australia. The Fremantle Literary Institute, very grandly named, just a couple of rooms up some steps above the greengrocer's shop or something. You know, they had an amazing array of books. I got a hell of a lot of Dickens out, and the great big old Victorian-style publications, all the line drawings and sketches, and had a kind of ritual in the winter when you didn't get out and about so much, of sitting up in bed on Sunday mornings, and I'd just read about 100 pages of Dickens at a time, which couldn't have done me any harm or anything.
When he was 15, Alan Seymour left school and found himself auditioning for a presenter's job at a local commercial radio station in Perth.
So they auditioned me and I became the youngest radio announcer in Western Australia, I think. And I used to tell people that. I was so proud of it, and they burst out laughing in my face. They thought it was such a silly accomplishment.
So you began writing for radio to plays, I think.
So I read. We used to do a live variety show every week. Live, everything went out live. We had no recording equipment anyway. And I would write a quarter-hour play, radio play, every week. I was 15, and we would all the different announcers who played all the comedy roles and the comedy sketches in this show. They would act all the parts, and I would act some too, and. And it was an extraordinary experience when you look back on it. I didn't know what I was being handed on a platter. And after 2 years of that, we all decided to come to Sydney. Then the ABC asked me to be a film critic, probably the youngest film critic in the world for that. And I read a quarter-hour radio film review every second week, I think it was. And then they asked if I'd like to join the staff as an announcer, which I did. I had two or three years as an ABC announcer. And then I'd built up a bit of a practice with the ABC running schools broadcasts for Guineas a Pop and documentaries on the Snowy Mountains and all that scheme and dramatisations of Oliver Twist and so on.
This was the halcyon period for radio too, wasn't it?
Radio was wonderful in those days. Everyone was interested in it. There was no television. It had a glamour and it had an immediacy somehow. People became besotted. Legions of people became idolatrous. Because I'd always wanted to write my plays, and there was not much outlet for playwriting in Australia. So I wrote a play called Swamp Creatures, which was in the repertoire for a while. A few people did it, and then it disappeared. Don't think it would survive being revived. And the Observer in London, a Sunday newspaper, ran a worldwide play competition, and it was among the 25 finalists. It didn't win a prize, but it was one of the finalists. And so that was got a mention by Kenneth Tynan in the columns and all that. So that helped me. And the ABC commissioned a radio version of that, which I did, and then a television version. By that time, television had come here, and I'd been doing a freelance basis for the ABC adaptations of stage plays for television, black and white television days. We did Richard II, Shakespeare.
It's almost incomprehensible to imagine Richard II being transferred to television, let alone live. Just tell me what was involved.
We needed two studios up at Gore Hill in the north of Sydney there to accommodate them. There are two armies in that play. And an actor called Rick Hutton, I think, has left us, played Richard. And I have no idea what it was like. It was good, bad or indifferent. But it was done whatever was the prevailing style. There was nothing too innovative about it. You just had no idea what a monument you were tackling, I suppose, then.
In cultural terms, Alan, was there a sense that television was a bit déclassé then, or was it the brave new media for writing?
I think it was a bit of each. I'd hardly be in a position to be snobbish, having started out in commercial radio. I loved it. I'd always loved the movies, and still do. Mm. There was a kind of film industry and a self-supporting one, a commercial one, unsubsidised, but it fluctuated. It just came and went over the years, and there'd be a good cycle, then it would disappear, then there'd be some more good, bad or indifferent films made, mostly black and white, like television in those days. And then, of course, later the 70s came along and we got the subsidies. But
presumably the theatre companies weren't looking for local scripts.
Ray Lawler's play, Summer of the 17th Doll, helped to change that. It was with great reluctance and timidity that the powers that be at the Elizabethan Theatre Trust finally dipped the toe in the water and dared to do it, and were astonished when it was such a great success. Because I think there was a great thirst in the public that they didn't even know about until they saw the chance to see this thing. They realised they wanted to see their own lives reflected.
Every year you still march down that street with that stupid, proud expression on your face. You glorify the bloody wastefulness of that day.
They don't care, do they? They don't believe in anything. What did I tell you? The whole country's going down the drain.
Was there a genesis for The One Day of the Year, which is the play that you're possibly best known for here in Australia? Was there... I'm wondering where its origins came from for you as a playwright.
With a musician friend of mine, I used to run a small opera company in the 1950s, and I directed the operas. And the Arts Council here, which I don't think exists anymore, sent us out on tour. It was 18-week tours, things like that, and from the tropics to the snows and all that stuff. And because we used singers who were professional but couldn't, like writers, couldn't earn a living then without any resident opera company here, we had to rehearse whatever we could, and we When we had a show coming up, we'd rehearse at nights and in the week and on weekends and on holidays. And one of the holidays was Anzac Day, and I came in to the centre of Sydney. I was living in the western suburbs in Summerhill at the time, and it came up the stairs at Town Hall Station, and there was all the crowds lining the streets. And I thought, oh, my God, it's Anzac Day, I've forgotten. Well, I threaded my way behind the crowds and to our rehearsal place, and we had our rehearsals, and I went home during that afternoon. As I walked through Summerhill, which had quite a few local pubs at that time, I saw it happening all around me, and I'd never been really out in the streets and among it on Anzac Day before then. And there was a lot going on. It doesn't go on so much these days, but you know, people don't like to be reminded of it. People like our Prime Minister doesn't like to be reminded of that side of it, thinks you should sweep it under the carpet, apparently. But it did happen. There was a lot of stuff going on, and people being attacked for one thing. Anyway, I was sort of astonished by that, and as I thought about it, I really bowled over by the dichotomy between the quietness and the reverence of the morning, the dawn, and so on, and the march. And the march is still very impressive. And all that happened in the afternoon. It's the solemn funeral, and then the wake afterwards with the feasting food and all the drink and everybody getting drunk and telling stories about the deceased and so on. Mm. It's not that far separated from that. I didn't quite perceive that at the time, although I did quite soon afterwards, and I obviously regretted that I somehow did. I don't know how I could have, but the boy too, he was even more humorless about it than the author was at that time.
You're telling him everything he's believed for 40 years is wrong? You're telling me what I believed in is nothing?
Believe in the men if you want to. They had guts. But the day, it's a mug's day.
The thing that annoyed me about it, though, it took a while for people to perceive that the real, because it was really quite savagely attacked at first, the real point of the play is the education to the emotions. He has his intellectual concept of what it's about, complicated by the emotions of the deep embarrassment he has with what his father is and does. And as the father remarks, the education that's taking him farther and farther away from them all the time. The education they wanted for him is dividing them. The boy had to learn that there is another side to it. It's not what the cold, hard facts say. Mm. And I still stand by it, I think that the men showed tremendous bravery and guts. From the people who organised it, the whole thing was a total fiasco. It was bungled. The concept was irrational and crazy in the first place, and it was ineptly handled. You know, they went in without proper maps and all sorts of things. They were expecting the impossible from those men. But when all that is said and done, it is an extraordinary thing for a nation to remember. As it says in the play, it is one of the few. Societies in the world which every year honours a defeat, not a victory, and which is a very strange, ironical, very downbeat and Australian way of doing things. All that fascinated me, and all that came into the play.
Well, what's the matter with a lot of yous? What's come over you? Well, you know what this day is. This day used to mean something once. Don't try to shut me up. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm proud to be a bloody Australian. If it wasn't for men like my old man, this country'd never been heard of. They put Australia on the map, they did, the Anzacs did, and bloody died doing it.
Where was the play first performed, Alan? Who took it up?
Adelaide. I'd written it and edited it in one of these play competitions. I'd written it on spec. They returned the manuscript to me, and within a matter of weeks or months, I got a letter from the drama committee of this is the first ever Adelaide Festival, 1960. It was about to begin in a few months' time, they're writing to a number of writers around who are already established or beginning to be established, and wondering if I had any play or that I could send to them. as it happened, I did. I just happened to have here my three-volume novel, you know. So I sent it, and the drama committee chose it out of the... I don't know how many plays they got. I've never known that. I might have had two. And then the main executive committee said, absolutely not. And a play knocking Anzac Day, come on. Because that's the primitive way, the terms in which they conceived it. And there were big protests from the committee, and strong men wept and so on. And they wouldn't bend, and the play was not done.
When it first appeared, the one day of the year, was, I think, an attack, a rather nasty, bitter sort of attack on soldiers who had volunteered and fought for their country. It showed them in more or less circumstances of inebriated gatherings and that sort of thing, and talked of the young people sneering at them. As a regular army man, my career was in the army, and this, I'm afraid, was more than I could take, and I told the board that if they put it on, they did it without me, and I was not going to have anything to do with it.
That was how Major General Hopkins, former commander of Duntroon and the administrator of the first ever Adelaide Arts Festival in 1960, articulated his dislike of the one day of the year. And it was his power on the festival board which effectively led to the withdrawal of the play from production. In defiance of the Festival Board's decision, a small, local, semi-amateur theatre group in Adelaide decided to put the play on, an action which led to full houses and critical acclaim for both Alan Seymour and the company.
It was a small group, like so many in those days, an amateur group with professional aspirations, with professional standards. They took it seriously, they knew a lot about the theatre, had a very intelligent approach, and they worked very hard. It wasn't amateur theatricals, it was well beyond that. And knowing that that was going on, the Australian Elizabethan Theatre Trust, who were the ruling body at the time, flew me over to Adelaide for the final rehearsals and the opening night. And I didn't know until months later that the Adelaide people who went along, many of them to show their annoyance at the ban on the festival, because they thought a play like this should have been in the festival. And they were sitting in that little hall, church hall it was, quaking with fear that the RSL or a few alcoholically loaded ex-servicemen might suddenly appear at the doors and start being abusive. Or
here it is. There's the opener there.
Yeah,
I've
got it.
I'm a bloody Australian, and I'll always stand up for bloody Australian.
For them, it was new. It's not new now. We've been listening to Australian playwrights and the Australian idiom for decades and decades. But then it had this wonderful shock of the new, and it was very refreshing.
Eye ties, bloody eye ties. You can't say anything to them. They still think they own the bloody earth. Well, they don't own the bloody earth.
The Trust sent Robin Lovejoy down, who was the key director at the time. And when he heard them laughing at the interchange among the characters, I've always been convinced that's when Robin thought, this play has commercial possibilities. It will really relate to an audience, an Australian audience. And he went back with a good report, and 6 months later he was directing the first professional production of it in Sydney, and then John Sumner did it with the Melbourne Theatre Company, and it went on from there, and then it went to London, and we took the original cast to London, and I thought the notices were not very good. One of my sisters collected them in a file and gave to me years later, and going through an old some trunk the other day, I found it again. And I thought, I wouldn't mind getting notices like that for any I wrote now. They're fairly reasonable, in fact. But it didn't go to the West End, and so after 5 weeks there, it finished. But it got me launched. People say, it was terrible. You were banned at Adelaide and the festival, and So you had to go to London? I said, no, I didn't have to go to London. I was doing quite well in Sydney, in fact, getting quite a bit of freelance work in television. I've read about 50 documentary films and radio. Mm. And the plays were beginning to go along a little bit. There was no real reason for me. I wasn't driven out of Australia for lack of opportunity. But I had to go to London for the London production. And a couple of months before, the ABC had commissioned an original television play, Biting the Bullet at Last, and I'd already been commissioned to write an original television play for one of the commercial channels here. They stole a march on the ABC. The first original television plays did not go out on the Australian plays did not go out on the ABC, but on commercial. And when I wrote this play, the director who was going down to direct it liked it very much. The script editor who'd commissioned it loved it. And the head of the drama department was absolutely scandalised and said, but you have an extreme left-wing man as your hero, a man who was, not to put too fine a point, it was ex-Communist Party. And it was set in the 1950s, early 1950s. And the Communist Party was a legal organisation, was a democracy, and the point of them, it was based on fact, because a case that happened in Tasmania, and the man who had a perfectly honourable record as an executive in a hydroelectric scheme was up for the really absolutely top job, and there's a little sort of cabal of people against him who threw up the fact that he was unsuitable because he'd once been in the Communist Party, and he'd been it when he was in his teens and his 18 or something, and he didn't like the way they tried to control his thinking, so he left after about 18 months, and a lot of people went through that. And it was about that case, which I was scandalised by that they would try to do that to him. So I wrote this play, and it never went on at the ABC. They never paid me for it. I bring that up every time anyone asks about it. They still owe me for it. And when I went to London, I had an agent already lined up, and he sold it to commercial television outlet there within the first 3 weeks of my arriving. And it was out on the screen 6 months later. I was commissioned to do another one, and then from then another one and another one. A lot of one-off plays done in those days. Mm-hmm. And in 4 years I had 8 television plays under my belt there. And it may not have gone as far as you would have wished, but it was just a breath of fresh air compared to everything else.
What was it like being an Australian in Britain in the early 60s? Were you considered an Antipodean?
As recently as 98, when I was back in London for a few months, and having dinner one evening with a youngish English couple, and they were fascinated by the fact that after all these years in London and other places, we were coming back to live in Australia again. And something or other about it, and I made just some dry sort of crack, you know. And this guy said, you know, you're quite sophisticated for an Australian. William, I can't believe this. You're about my closest English friend, and we've known each other for over 20 years. How can you make such a patronising remark? You think you're giving me a compliment while you're putting down my country? Come off, you know. I mean, they can't help it, even now. And yet, I've always liked adapting things. And when BBC Children's Television wanted to do one of their classics, C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, quintessentially English, I really liked the fact that they chose an ageing Antipodean writer.
Writer Alan Seymour recalling his years living by his pen, first in Australia and later in Britain. Technical production today has been by Judy Rapley, and I'm Michelle Rayner.